take a minute to check your social battery. How's it doing? It's easy to ignore our needs and spread ourselves too thin. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/popcastpod today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/popcastpod. Hey, yeah,
yeah. Welcome to the New York Times Podcast, your Mutron biphase pedal of music criticism and analysis. I'm your host, John Pareles. And we just heard Answers Me by Arthur Russell, which you may recognize as one of the essential ingredients of Kanye West's 30 Hours. I'm here with Ben Ratliff, who has been into the Arthur Russell archives. And let's talk about this composer who keeps turning up in the strangest places years after he died.
It's an amazing thing. Arthur Russell was a singer, songwriter, cellist, composer, lived in New York from the early 70s until 1992 when he died at the age of 40, died of AIDS, complications from AIDS. When he died, he was known to a few as a brilliant and sort of hard to understand musician, kind of hard to contain because his interests were all over the place. He made great disco records. He made great sort of country rock records. And he made great records that I guess you could explain by saying they were in the experimental music tradition. But
well, they were minimalism too. I mean, I was
they
around
had something
then
to do with minimalism for sure.
I mean, listening to him now reminds me of the New York that I came to when I was younger, and it was a time when you would go to the Kitchen, a place that Russell was the curator for a while. You'd go to the Kitchen in Soho and climb up to a loft, and you might see a minimalist person twanging one tone for 4 hours, or you might see the Beastie Boys, or you might see some kind of rhythmic rock band, or you might see Fab Five Freddy playing with Max Roach. All of these categories were being knocked down. I mean, now we live in this post-genre wilderness, but at the time it was really decisive and brave for these people to be breaking these walls down.
They were doing it. It wasn't being done for them.
Right.
That's what you're saying. Yeah.
Russell was, he liked minimalism. He loved loops. He loved repetition. He loved all of the things that he also heard in dance music.
Yeah. So real quick explanation of the arc of his posthumous fame. A couple years after he died, Philip Glass's record label Point put together, with the help of the composer Michael Rouse, a collection of songs that he left behind on his tapes, a record called Another Thought. A few more people knew about Arthur Russell at that point, but still, like, no big tipping point. And then around 2000, well, around the turn of the century, there was a compilation called Disco Not Disco. That's like, it was like 70s and 80s dance music that was kind of like stretching the boundaries of, you know, typical dance music. And there are a couple of his tracks on that. Then maybe 2002, something like that, there was a compilation called The World of Arthur Russell. And at that point, Audica Records was born, launched by this guy named Steve Knutson, who basically thereafter put all his energy toward reissuing, going into the vaults of what Russell left behind to give the world a much better picture of what Arthur Russell was all about. So since then, let's say 2004, 12 years ago, there's been this incredible gradual buildup of interest among practically anybody who's doing sort of left-of-center work. Grizzly Bear, Dev Hynes of Blood Orange, Juliana Barwick, et cetera, et cetera. It's almost become—
And Kanye West, too.
And Kanye West, too, although I'm not aware of Kanye West saying in interviews, I love Arthur Russell, but he did something even stronger, which was to take an Arthur Russell track and use it as the basis for one of his own tracks, 30 Hours on the Life of Pablo.
Well, I've been thinking that we choose our ancestors. Artists choose their ancestors. And so a lot of the instincts we're seeing now in music of, you know, trying to get that left field thing that goes with something popular,
yeah,
trying to get that monkey wrench that makes your dance track strange and interesting,
yeah,
was what Arthur Russell was doing back in the 70s and 80s.
It's all well and good to say, oh, people are always looking for, you know, dead heroes, or people are always looking for that perfectly obscure figure that they can point to and say, that one's mine, you know, I'm all about that. But I think there's more to it than that. I mean, I think people are responding to really concrete sounds and ideas in Arthur Russell's work.
Well, for instance?
Well, his voice, for one thing. I mean, there's something really bewitching about his voice, especially as it moved into the early and mid-80s, and the sound of his singing on that record, World of Echo. World of Echo is just Arthur Russell alone with a cello and some effects boxes. It sounds like all of it was conceived, worked out, practiced, perfected, like late at night or in isolation. I mean, it's such an interior thing.
And but which is that mood now of everybody in their bedroom studios,
yeah,
making
right,
future R&B.
Yeah, that's right. It's what everybody wants to accomplish. And it's his mode of singing. It's quiet and soulful and mysterious. And also, for me, there's a kind of country music link. I mean,
there's definitely a country music link.
I always feel like he sounds like he's from the Lefty Frizzell tradition of singing, you know, which that would later be the Merle Haggard style of singing.
And the cello is a big fiddle for him, too, sometimes.
True. So you, John Pareles, I'm jealous of you for many reasons, but one of the reasons I'm jealous of you for presently is that you saw Arthur Russell play that music, the World of Echo music.
I did, at the Kitchen.
At the Kitchen.
And what I remember through the many decades of concerts is how shy he seemed, how interior he seemed, how almost leaning over the cello in fetal position, just making this very introverted music.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, he was a disco guy, too, in his other incarnations.
Although apparently he didn't like dancing.
But that concert I saw was very, if you weren't going to be drawn into it, you know, it wasn't for you. And I think I was a little resistant at the time, but, mm-hmm, you know, as I play back World of Echo now, you can see that there is country in there. There is the love of gadgetry in there. There's also the love of systematic processes creating the music.
Yeah.
The news hook here, by the way, is that the New York Public Library just acquired his archives.
That's right.
Which is notebooks, cassette tapes, manuscripts. Tell us about that, because you've been into this monster trove.
Yeah. So Arthur Russell's archive is 166 linear feet, I'm told, of tapes and papers. And the tapes are all kinds of tapes: reels, DATs, cassettes, beta, VHS. A lot of them are things that have been, you know, gone through finely for release. So, like, the cream has already been sifted off. We know that. But it doesn't make it any less interesting, because what we have been learning through years of Arthur Russell scholarship, including a biography by Tim Lawrence and a documentary movie, and also very recently a dissertation by a guy named Matthew Marble, a composer and scholar who lives out in Oregon. What we know now is that process was very important to Arthur Russell. Yeah, there are some records now that have been heavily edited. The music has been post-edited by Russell himself or by other people. But there's something more to be found in what he did sort of on a daily basis, using tapes as sketchbooks, basically, for tracking, for jamming, for practicing. It's hard to figure out whether he was a perfectionist or the exact opposite.
Or just indecisive.
You know, it's like, it's one of those things where everything is connected to its flip side. Some people say that he had trouble letting things go, you know, that he had trouble finishing things and moving on to the next thing.
Hi, Kanye.
Exactly. How about that? There's the connection. But also, he clearly was really aware of this as a philosophical process.
Well, he did study. He studied Eastern religion.
Yes.
And there is the mantric tradition where you repeat and repeat and repeat to the point of stillness and clarity.
Yes.
I hear lots of looping, echoing music as mantric, as echo and repetition in that almost spiritual sense.
Yeah. And also, I think he was very interested in the idea of being able to contain a thought and the negation of that thought at the same time, you know? And his notebooks, his paper notebooks, I mean, his tapes are one kind of notebook, but his paper notebooks are full of little notes to himself, particularly around World of Echo, which was, it is clear, much more than a record, you know? It was a series of performances of which you saw one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was like it was a way of thinking. Like, it was a system for him, but a very loose and open system.
So, well, it was a system to generate openness. And
yeah,
all.
Yeah. There you go. He was into building, generating systems. I think that's exactly right. So, like, here are some of the notes he wrote that I copied down. The creation of a musical system which accepts any musical input. He wrote, although World of Echo uses no song structure, it could just as easily use it. He wrote, the construction of structure which can be abandoned at any moment and that is transparent. So he wanted to make an endless amount of work that could be revised at any time. He could always get back, again, Kanye, he could always get back into it and change it. And that would be one of the, one of its defining features, you know?
Well, there's also something you mentioned in your article about words, lyrics that could be heard three or four different ways that he mumbles.
Yes.
So he wanted the multiplicity of meaning. He wanted the ambiguity. He wanted the blur that you would project yourself into.
He absolutely did. There's no question. World of Echo is, to me, one of the most original things that anybody's done. I mean, it's one of my favorite records, and my estimation of it just keeps going up over time. And it's full of these beautiful melodies, beautifully sung. They seem right on the line the way they're presented as like the purest improvisation and something that's really been worked out over time. It's like, who's to know, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But they were notated, and, you know, you can find these songs in his composition books. And one of the songs that I love the most is called Soon to Be Innocent Fun. I've wanted to know what the lyrics are because I have no idea. I can't tell. So going into this huge archive, you know, you're confronted with a mass of paper, and you just think, your mind goes blank, you know? And so I just started with, all right, well, what am I looking for? So I thought, well, I want to find lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I want. That's what I want. So the first day of going through the archive, I just spent looking for World of Echo lyrics. And I found it. I found the lyrics to Soon to Be Innocent Fun, which sounds like such a beautiful, meaningful song. You know what the lyrics are? And love in test, ever best, how will it float in when you see doubt, and so that over and see that any be seed, yeah. I mean, like, it's almost like cut up writing.
You might know, well it, be.
It's almost like random generator writing. And for certain words, he had three different possibilities that he could sing at will, depending on what he felt like. So here's a guy with a big brain, you know, I mean.
Well, it's the infinitely branching structure he talks about.
Yeah, yeah. So, but let's go back in his history, back from the World of Echo time. We came in with Answers Me from World of Echo, which was recorded sometime in the mid-80s. But let's go back in his chronology to instrumentals and hear a track from the record, Instrumentals. So that's Instrumentals Volume 1.
Which I just got to hear at Moogfest.
Yes. So last week you were in Durham, North Carolina at Moogfest, and you got to hear that music live.
Played by, it was actually like being in the kitchen in the 80s. It was played by the musicians who used to hang out with him and be his sidemen and work with him. Peter Gordon on saxophone, Peter Zumo on trombone. A whole bunch of faces that looked really familiar and deja vu to me. And we just looked at this dissertation that you've plunged into, that, but I didn't know about, because Instrumentals is two parts. I think he calls them Volume 1 and Volume 2. Mm-hmm. And the first is a series of melodies with a rock beat, very forthright, very straightforward seeming. And the second is these incredible slow drones out of which instruments suddenly erupt, which was the second half especially was pretty mind-boggling, sitting in a beautiful movie palace and watching. You did not know what going to happen. But the first half, the melodic half, was also generated by this matrix of tones that he had put together. Can you explain this?
Not that well, but this is something that I've only recently learned about through reading Matthew Marble's dissertation.
Because when you're sitting there, they sound like movie themes. You know, they sound like tunes you would put right for a movie soundtrack. But instead...
Well, so this dissertation for Matthew Marble's doctorate in philosophy at Princeton is called Buddhist Bubblegum, and it's about esoteric musical practices and methods that Arthur Russell used. And so he had what Marble describes is that Russell had a matrix system that he would use to, you know, constantly recombine things, right? That's about as far as I can go in describing it right now without making mistakes
notes.
And getting tangled. Yep, so that's
76
right.
notes and chosen companion notes?
Yeah.
I mean, this isn't just a guy humming a tune and writing it down.
Well, I think the idea behind Instrumentals, too, was that it could always be different depending on, you know, which way you use the matrix, which way you decide to order things. So when you heard it last weekend, would you have been able to tell any of this?
No.
So it sounded more like something that was through composed, maybe, and
the second
pop
half
minimalism or.
Well, yeah, I mean, the first half was nice tunes.
Yeah.
And, you know, a good, straightforward, peppy beat. And then the second half was drones and eruptions.
Yeah.
The dissertation we just looked at said he talked about going across the chords as if he was in a boat. I can hear that in retrospect.
Yeah.
It carried me back to the kitchen where they were throwing together minimalism and durational things and repetition with pop structures and trying to figure out where these intersected. It was of its time, but it was ahead of its time, too. I mean, it was of its time then in the tiny avant-garde zone, and now it's where we all live.
And then there's his pop thing. It's interesting, the dance music side of him is the side of him that a lot of people connect with. He made music that was popular at, like, the Paradise Garage.
Right.
You know, discos, late 70s discos.
Primordial discos.
Yeah, right. He made really interesting dance records, usually not under his name, usually under project names like Dinosaur L.
Or Loose Joints.
Or Loose Joints. And he would hire the people that he needed for, you know, he often used the same musicians over and over, like the trombonist Peter Zumo, who you saw with that ensemble in Durham. Mustafa Ahmed, a percussionist, he used him a lot. And various singers, like session singers, that whose voices he felt close to. He clearly was really into music from the coasts. He was into New York music and he was into California music. You know, he was really into disco, dance music. And he was really into Fleetwood Mac, Ned Doheny. Does that name ring a bell?
Yeah, that's can't get more California.
The Beach Boys. He was into numerology, and there's a page in one of his notebooks where he does a numerological analysis of the names of, I guess, some of his favorite groups, including the Eagles and Fleetwood Mac and Beach Boys. He used numerological systems also to come up with names for compositions. And
I always wondered where some of those came from.
And for bands. Yeah, right. They seem to have some, like, occult significance, right? Everything was arrived at through method, through process with this guy.
There's a lot of intuition behind the process. Because what we respond to the first time you hear his voice, the first time you sort of try to figure out what he's singing is, there's a plaintiveness in him. There's a prairie openness to him. You know, he was from Iowa. I don't hear it as math rock. I don't hear it as some academic composer working something out. I hear someone trying to vocalize what's in his heart.
Yeah.
And the cello is such an expressive instrument, and his voice is an expressive instrument.
Well, I want to give it up one more time to this guy, Matthew Marble, the scholar, who I think has done some kind of groundbreaking work, because other than Tom Lee, Arthur Russell's partner, and Steve Knutson, who's been putting out all these, you know, issues of Arthur Russell records, I think Matthew Marble is maybe the only person who has heard as much as there is to hear, or for him that he is able to hear, and who's gone through the archives so finely. He really knows the papers. And actually, talking to him, he brought up the concept of intuition. He said to me that in music, I'm going to just quote from his conversation with me. In music, you don't really talk about intuition, even though everybody knows it's a core part of music. When we're talking about intuition, we tend to reduce it to jazz. Like jazz, that's the music that uses intuition, you know, to improvisation, basically. But he said, you know, what Arthur Russell's music shows is that he developed his own discipline of intuition, right? I mean, this is basically what you're saying.
Yeah.
Discipline, intuition, they might seem to be at odds, but he figured out a way to make them come together and to make them generate.
I agree with you, Ben. Discipline and intuition were kind of uniquely bonded in Arthur Russell. He was drawing his music from a lot of disparate places, but can you suggest something that where he pulls it all together?
The people I've spoken to who knew him all point to World of Echo as a work that contains a lot of parts of what he was and what he was interested in. Even though it's just him and cello and effects boxes, in it you hear dance music, you hear North Indian, sort of. You hear
words. You hear singer-songwriter.
You hear singer-songwriter impulses. And you also hear mantric singing. But then, you know, outside of World of Echo, there's a song like In the Light of the Miracle. It's a dance song, but it's also kind of strummy, and it's also intoned. You know, it's another one of these kind of, I don't know, there's something sort of devotional about it.
Well, it goes on for a while.
It goes on for a while. It repeats. Yeah, it's really—
It's ritualistic in a way.
Yeah, right. It's ritualistic, and it's really gorgeous.
And catchy, too.
Yeah.
So why don't we go out on that, In the Light of the Miracle by Arthur Russell. So that was Arthur Russell's In the Light of the Miracle, and that's our New York Times podcast for this week. Ben Ratliff, thank you.
Thanks, John.
Please read Ben's article at nytimes.com/music on Arthur Russell's archive. Check out our Spotify playlist, which will take you deeper into the world of Echo. Keep an eye out for the Arthur Russell papers at the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts. Sometime in the next year, those are going to be very accessible and, I'm sure, very fascinating. Thanks for listening. I'm John Pareles. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and we'll see you next week.